This is not the sermon I thought last Monday I would preach. I got that sermon ready and hung on to it for quite a while, even though some things were happening around me that said, how can you stand in the pulpit on Sunday and give us only a passing paragraph? I probably resist that kind of pressure more than I should, because I like the pulpit to be something other than a place of commentary on local and world events, about which there are likely to be far better commentaries made all week than I can make anyway. Some of you were surprised that I said so little about the Gulf War, except in pastoral prayers. But I know the reason for that. I had some very mixed feelings about that war, and I believed that most of the sensitive and intelligent people who make up my audiences on Sundays had enough ambivalence of their own without having to hear mine. The actual fighting turned out to be so brief, only a matter of hours, that comments from the pulpit hardly had a chance. And when the parades and celebrations began, and I had some other ambivalences about our rejoicing in our strength and in how our massive superiority had made the war a kind of, what did we call it? Duck shoot? I counted on you to ask yourselves, is this really the time for believers in God to party? You graciously leave such decisions up to me and do not insist that I preach according to each current event. And my notions about the pulpit are such that I do not wish it to be a shrill place, reacting to the daily news instead of holding up eternal truth and dealing with the problems of human personality that go on forever and ever, no matter how the world changes. One reason for that, I suppose, is that I have learned how ultimately trivial many things are about which the press and the pulpit and the politicians are likely to make great noises, and that a wait of only a few days will suffice to see most of them forgotten anyway. But this week has been different, and I have felt compelled to share some thoughts with you that were not on the agenda when I chose the sermon I chose late in the week to postpone. It is not a cliche when I speak of sharing some thoughts. I have no thought of preaching in the usual sense, where one who considers himself a prophet of God thunders advice and commandments at an audience made respectful and passive because they are at worship. It may be that I need to say what I will say this morning far more than you need to hear it, but I am comfortable with that too, knowing that you will understand and be patient. Before this last week, I would have said that the last 2 years had been the most surprising and unexpected of my entire life. The destruction, for example, of that infamous wall in Berlin, symbol for the larger part of my lifetime of the forces of tyranny and oppression, an ugly place where people trying to flee to freedom were shot dead or blown to bits by minefields or chased down by dogs. Concrete at its coldest, covered with graffiti, stained with blood. Surely one of the most monstrous, tangible signs of the closed and tyrannical mind ever built. And then, unbelievably, we saw the sudden and complete collapse of that wall, with all the attendant images of young people scrambling up to beat it into pieces with sledgehammers and pickaxes, while their parents, who had lost all hope that they might ever walk by their own choice to the other side of town, stood in the streets and wept for joy. That alone, after 40 years, would have been enough to keep us excited for a long time. But there came next a flood of other things to overwhelm our emotions. The stunning collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, with country after country reaching out for long-lost freedoms, wiping their feet on hated flags, toppling statues they would only a few days before have been shot for insulting with so much as a word, and trying desperately to figure out how democracy works when one has had no experience of it in almost two generations or longer. We watched it on that incredible screen we now take for granted, but which beyond question is one of the most potent forces humanity has ever possessed. And in our quiet living rooms, night after night, we ate our popcorn and marveled at the things that come tumbling one on top of another. The unification of Germany, we had thought it might last forever, a divided nation. The new words coming from what one of our presidents called the evil empire, words like glasnost and perestroika, words we had no idea were in the Russian vocabulary, words that through our lifetimes would have been met by bullets. What in the world was happening to the world? Can you remember? It seems so much longer ago than it was. Can you remember how strange and exhilarating it was to have Russia on our side during the troubles with Saddam Hussein, instead of threatening to blow us to kingdom come if we dared send a huge army that close to their country? We loved talking later about how powerful we were and how quickly the war was won, forgetting like happy children that had it been the old order, we could not have moved about so freely, nor dared to be so dominant. And then after all those frozen years, the arms reduction talks and treaties, the relaxation of the immigration laws in Russia, it was bewildering. It seemed a crazy, improbable dream at times. The world split between two huge superpowers for such a long, long time, and suddenly everything changing. I could not imagine that anything could top the dizzying transformations of the last couple of years. But last week proved me wrong. Last week, we had that sudden, terrifying nightmare for some 36 hours when the Russian people faced the prospect that all their bright new hopes might be drowned in blood, and when a handful of desperate men held in their hands a briefcase with codes that, had they wished or dared, might have been held over our heads to take us instantly back to the Cold War. I'm sure some of us said when they kidnapped the general secretary of their Communist Party. Oh well, what else would one expect from the Russians? And resigned ourselves to watching the old enemy rise in the same old frightening form from the brief experiment with freedom. But then came the proof. I would call it incredible, amazing, inconceivable, except that even those predictable words are pitiably inadequate. Then came the proof that the love of freedom can be as powerful as our own songs and our own Bill of Rights have said it is. Call the coup foolish or poorly planned, as you look at it in hindsight. But remember that the people in Russia who yearned for democracy had no way of knowing that at first. I hope no one listening to me is so jaded that the sight of those defiant people risking death for the little shred of freedom they had so recently gained did not provoke a tear of compassion and admiration. We settled down, I did certainly, for a drama that would be unfolding for years, a slow battle between the new yearning for freedom and the old forces of repression. And then before we knew it, the coup collapsed. The reformers were dancing in the streets. The hammer and sickle was replaced by the old Russian flag. Even the dreaded KGB was openly defied, and the statue of its founder was lifted by a huge crane and dropped ignominiously in the street. Surely, I thought yesterday afternoon as I drove this way to a wedding, nothing else so totally improbable can happen. But I turned on the radio, and it had already happened. Mr. Gorbachev had resigned as General Secretary of the Communist Party. The party itself was declared dead and useless. Even the Ukraine, that vast, vast farmland and industrial power, had declared its independence. If you had predicted such things in a book 3 years ago, your reading audience would have been small to begin with, and most of them would have thought you had lost your mind to idle daydreams. We have been taught a wonderful lesson about the irrepressible yearning of the human heart to live in freedom. No one, of course, can live on the edge of the chair filled with exultation all the time at the thought of how great it is to be free, and so inevitably we take it for granted. But not right now, surely. How can we not rejoice right now with these people who are trying to control their own destiny with no experience to help them? And don't you feel some tender compassion toward them when you think of how costly and how risky they will discover freedom is, and how much pain and challenge it always brings along with its blessed rewards? All of a sudden, we had a reminder of how powerful and mysterious this thing is that we call freedom. We have lived with the right to speak out and vote in change for so long that we have forgotten the absolute intoxication of such liberty to those who have been deprived of it. In truth, we have grown indifferent to our liberty. Only half of us bother to vote. And when we become blasé about freedom, we forget even our religious heritage. I hear the Apostle Paul shouting in his letter to the Galatians, "Freedom is what we have. Christ has set us free. Stand firm then as free people and do not allow yourselves to become slaves again." Political freedom was not what he had in mind, because political freedom was beyond all hope at the moment. But religious freedom had come. Paul passionately believed, as a gift from Christ, the right to individual interpretation, the right of the individual conscience to make itself heard, and the sacred duty to respect those rights even when your neighbor's opinion is annoyingly different from your own. Freedom is always a fragile thing, but for the moment, it is triumphant. It is all right to rejoice this morning. It may be hard for those who have made a lifelong habit of blaming everything in the world on communism to find the enemy vanished, whom they had needed to hate. But perhaps it will force our eyes inward and make us see more clearly all those ways in which we hurt ourselves. My academic discipline cautions me to be always a little skeptical, to know the risks of easy optimism. But this morning, for these few minutes, I put the skepticism aside and rejoice. I had not supposed that in my lifetime I might be able to say to an audience that perhaps the Russian people may, after 70 years, get a chance to build a new society worthy of them. If you have known the novelists and the poets, the composers and the philosophers who have risen in that country and blessed it and blessed the whole world, then you can surely hope with me that morning really has broken in Russia after a long dark night, and that we have entered a new era. I say Godspeed to the beleaguered but joyous Russian people. I hold in my heart their pain and their victory. I pray gladly from this Western pulpit that in an open society they may know the truth, and that the truth will make them free.